Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Okay, you two Western aficionados. All right. Courtney.
Yes, sir.
You're the man who should know. You should know this.
That was Elmer, obviously. I believe that was the Comancheros.
Yeah, outstanding. Very good catch. You know, John Wayne has to be the only Western actor that brought his own theme music with him. I mean, his theme music was always so good.
Well, as a matter of fact, Steve's on the other line there. Elmer Bernstein did the music for Steve's version of The Telltale Heart when he was at the American Film Institute.
Oh, my gosh.
Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, well, by golly, this is LA Talk Radio, and you are listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, extraordinaire Jim Christina, and on the phone with me tonight is my lovely, charming, beautiful, bewildering co-host, Bobby Jean Bell, coming to you directly from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
You just gotta love any show that starts with sweeping music from a Western.
I know, huh?
You know, you just have to stay tuned. You don't touch that dial, you know.
No,
you just
never
know,
touch that dial.
You just know don't. Something amazing is going to follow.
I know, and it's two Western guys, so what are you going to do?
I'm going to be mostly quiet.
Well,
please don't.
Well, absolutely. Those of you who have been listening, we have on the phone with us tonight, Mr. Steve Carver and, of course, Mr. Courtney Joyner. And they are the co-writers of a wonderful, wonderful film called, Western Unsung Heroes and Villains of the Silver Screen. And, Steve, you were on with us, or so with Courtney, too, in September last year. Or 2016.
Can you believe it?
and you were working on this book then.
That's right. Been working on a book since 1996.
There you go. And it finally came out November last year.
That's right.
After a much, much vaunted delay through Amazon and everything else and your publisher. But it is out and it's selling like hotcakes. I mean, I take a look at the people who love this book, and everybody loves this book, myself included.
Thank you.
And I mean, Steve, we talked about this before, and it's like how you got all these people just to, I mean, they look so good and so natural and so like real.
It's lighting, smoke, and mirrors.
Oh, it's deeper than that.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I went into it last time. It has a lot to do with the technique.
Right.
And a lot to do with the old-fashioned photography.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you.
And the photos, and then you get Courtney's descriptions and the bios of the actors next to it, and it's just a complete story. It's just a great book.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, you know, Jim, when you say story, I think that's a really operative word here, because I think Steve is probably being a little modest, but as he approached every session, certainly all the ones where I was present, as if he was directing a feature film, and the subjects approached it in the same way. They were adopting characters, and they were getting even within their wardrobe and their makeup and what have you, to help transport themselves to the correct time period and, more importantly, the correct attitude. So it really was a creation of something as opposed to, if you will, something that was just candid and caught off guard.
Right.
And I think that made a tremendous difference because, let's say, photographs from that period are almost always posed.
Because
you had to have the exposure, the time, you know, in order to have the shutter open to get the photograph in the first place. That's why they took so many photographs of dead bodies.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Because you had to
sit there for like 10 seconds and not blink.
Absolutely. Well, actually, not you know, just I think the longer. It was 14 seconds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a secret, actually, because the amount of time is equivalent to the 5 minutes in those days.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They did it for 5 minutes or even longer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But called ghost photography, and there's a lot of ghosting involved, which is the blurring of the subject.
Right, right. Right. Now, I have a question, Steve, and I don't know if you can answer this. And maybe it's just the way things were done back in the 1800s and early 1900s. But when you see portraits of couples, and Bobby Jean, maybe you've noticed this and often wondered about it. Why is it the man is always sitting and the woman is standing up behind him?
That was just a formality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that she looked better standing.
Oh, well, yeah.
Sitting and you know, he looked better sitting.
It was the drape of the clothing, don't you think?
I beg your pardon?
It's a drape of her clothing compared to like a rumpled suit.
That's correct. I think a lot had to do with the fashion.
Yeah. I have a picture or a couple pictures of my grandparents back in the 1920s. And she was standing behind him, and he was I don't remember what it was. He was wearing a fez, so what would that be? One of those, mm-hmm. yeah. Anyway, one of those lodges. But
I think it's also that physical dynamic. Also, too, and Steve, tell me what you think of this theory, because especially when you look at the very famous portraits of Etta Place with Butch Cassidy,
right?
Belle Starr with Blue Duck. Now, these women also were usually very short.
Right. And it's seeing a man would make him the same height.
Yes.
Or close to
it. I think that also played a big, big part in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also have to remember at this time, having your photograph taken, it was an expense. And you didn't do it lightly. It wasn't like today with Instagram and whatever. I mean, it was quite an occasion, whether you went to a studio or you had a photographer that came to your home. Think of pictures even of people in front of their sod shanties with everything they owned out there with them, including animals on the rooftop.
Right.
I mean, right. You know, it was a way that you captured you captured that moment, which became history in your family, the way great portrait painters had done before that time. And now it became a little more accessible to every man, but it was still, you know, I can remember Docentine at the Autry and kids asking, well, why don't they ever smile? It's like, you had to hold that pose, smiling and holding that pose. And it was somewhat serious. You wanted to look, you know, kind of your best. You just don't really see people doing a lot of smiling.
Well, no, you had to smile for 14 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, and also, of course, the portrait photography, such as is honored in the book, of course, predated newspaper photography.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because there was no way initially to reproduce photographs in newspapers. So this mm-hmm. was something for the person.
Right.
And, yeah, that also, I think, created a different dynamic. Of course, things started to change after the Civil War. But that was, and our good friend on the other line recreated all of that and more.
Yeah, he did. He did. And I have to tell you, Steve, as I told you before, these photos are just like they're awesome.
Well,
I mean, oh, you're very welcome. I mean, they have just the right amount of everything in there.
They're compelling. Whether you know who these actors are, who the people are in the photograph, I think that's what I see historically moving forward through the next 100 years, is that people who maybe aren't that familiar with the films will be as intrigued with what you've caught. Very important moment in history and in the lives of these people. I know many are no longer with us, and you may have actually captured them for all time, which is so important.
Yeah, it's very, it's poignant in some cases, as like R.G. Armstrong and a few of the other people that have left us since their photos were taken.
Yeah, there are 17 actors that have passed since
this
book.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And five just in the past 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Not surprising, since you started this in 96. Are there more pictures? Are there more portraits, Steve, that you're wanting to get that, obviously wouldn't be in this book? Are there still people that you're working with, or has the project kind of ended?
Well, the project ended, but I'm being contacted by several actors that have seen the book.
Yeah.
And would like to do another volume.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that would be slick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there's two ideas floating around and getting to the publisher. One is to do another 17 actors and create an extended edition, or to do another volume and do another 80 or so actors, because there are another 80 or 100 that can go under a into another volume.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a wonderful compliment, but also a slightly frustrating one, because now that you see how gorgeous the book is and the terrific the presentation and the work, it's, oh my gosh, I remember you wanted me to do that.
Yeah,
why didn't that work out? It's like, yeah, we only asked it 40 times. Yeah.
Well, isn't that always the way, though, really?
Yes, it is.
Now, you had an exhibition. Tell us a little bit about what happened in November when it finally got published, and how the world got to see it, and maybe a little bit about what's ongoing. I know there are still things happening with Rob Word. You want to tell us a little bit about all of the excitement and the hoopla that's gone on?
Well, Courtney, you can probably elaborate better than I can.
Oh, for the excitement and the hoopla?
Yeah, you were in the middle of it. I was stunned.
It really was pretty amazing because, of course, Rob has that great, Word on Westerns meetings and luncheons every month up there at the Autry. And Rob had been a really terrific help and contributed so much to the book. And, of course, he's featured in it. And we had always wanted to do kind of a special Word on Westerns that would center around the book, because so many of the subjects, of course, have been interviewed up there and honored up at the Autry and all of that stuff. And then it just went nuclear, basically. We ended up with how many people from the pages where there's, I can't remember, it was 41, right? 41
yeah,
or 42?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
It was absolutely incredible, not only because it showed this just enormous support factor from everyone who participated in the volume itself, wonderful outpouring for Steve's work and for what I contributed, which was just so generous and terrific, but that also all the people who arrived to buy the book or had gotten it. It was a little tough to get it initially because we had a few, mail ordering problems and things like that, and so they were grabbing it at from local retailers and at the museum store, and it was selling out like crazy. And of course, they walk in there, and here are 41 of the featured people from the pages all there, all stayed to sign the book and be part of the presentation, and their enthusiasm and commitment, and was just, it was absolutely astonishing. And there were easily over 100 additional people, probably more, who were there with the book to buy it and have it signed by everyone. It was really something.
Mm-hmm.
Way beyond our expectations.
What blew me away was one of the actors who had had a stroke actually showed up. And that really blew me away. I couldn't believe he
sure did. He made that effort. Yeah, we had a couple of people who had not been in the best of health or whatever, and they just wanted to be there to show their support for the book, also to see their old friends. And it was just a wonderful afternoon. It was very emotional and very, really moving, not just because of their outpouring for the book and the work that we did, but also for each other. It was like this fantastic grand reunion. It really was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And those actors that hadn't been able to show up, we had another signing a couple of weeks later, and we had all those actors come that didn't show up, plus the actors at the Autry that had showed up. So we
wow.
had another group, and that was incredible, too.
And that was at the Dark Delicacies bookstore there in Burbank. And, mm-hmm. You know, guys, you know Del and Sue, and we sold out there as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh,
it was
so
just, yeah, it's just been wonderful as far as everyone's just support and the enthusiasm just is never ending. It's because they love the final product, which really mm-hmm. is very gratifying.
Well, it's actually just a testament also to the quality of the photography, but then also the love of the Old West that still lingers.
Yes. And also the quality of the book itself.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Incredible job.
It's absolutely gorgeous.
I went through a lot with the printers in Germany and with you know, the technicians that actually put the book together.
Uh-huh.
You know, with the publishing people. And this was all done long distance. And the idea that they understood exactly what we were aiming to do with the book and the quality that I was hoping for. They actually came through with an incredible product.
Yeah, they did. It is an incredible product, and you are to be applauded. So there you go. There's your clap.
I have a question. In the book you've chosen, the folks that you've chosen are character. They're mostly actors that have played character roles in Westerns and in many, many, many other films typically, but well-known in Westerns. What's important about capturing the character actors? Why is that important?
I think they're more exciting than the actual stars. I think they're more interesting. They carry the film, in my opinion, you know, better than the stars. When I say better, I mean my eye goes to them, and I look forward to seeing them from film to film. The star is important to the film. Obviously, it sells the film and gets the people in the door, but the character actor makes the story work. And to me, that's what films are all about. Those actors that are the glue to the film, to the
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm. And Court, when you write as a writer, your side characters are very important, aren't they? Talk a little bit about that character role in
Hold
the
that
writing
thought.
Of it.
Oh, hold okay. that thought. We've got to go to a okay. commercial, but we'll be back in
okay.
just a few seconds.
I'm holding.
Well, you know, one of our big sponsors here on the Writer's Block is LA Talk Radio, and we just can't say enough about them. From the owner of the studios down to the engineers to the people who help you get on the air, they're just a phenomenal bunch of people. And let's hear a little bit about them.
Hey, it's Jim Christina here.
Maybe not.
Pesky little AM dial. Then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is the biggest and the best in LA, and is a .com, so we have it all, from sports to music to self-help to, well, just about anything, including talk. And right now, it's coming right at you. Why don't you sit back and enjoy at www.latalkradio.com.
And believe it or not, there actually are more shows on the LA Talk Radio other than the Writer's Block. Although I do have to say, we have a great time doing this show. And it was amazing that we were able to do it from both Bobby and I being out of the state. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it turned out really well for us. Here's the question for you, Steve. You have a lot of people in here that are kind of archaic. And one of them I've noticed was... when I was thumbing through your book, was Johnny Crawford. And Court and I had the pleasure of meeting Johnny Crawford in 2018, I believe, wasn't it, Court?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I know Johnny for a long time.
At the Cowboy Festival. Mm-hmm. And I got a chance to thank him for his kindness when I was, I think, 11. And he was filming The Rifleman in the middle of the San Fernando Valley, and he took time out to talk to my brothers and my sisters, and I just always thought that was really nice, and he was just a really nice guy. And I mentioned that to him, and he didn't remember, unfortunately, because, you know, he's kind of forgetful these days, but I see him sitting there, and then I look at all the other people, and I think, wow, you know, this is, you got Johnny Crawford to sit still and look like that into the camera. Mm-hmm. It had to have been something, because he kind of moves around a lot.
Right. Well, when he first came in the studio, he brought a lariat. And that's all he did, was twirl the...
Oh, is that right?
Around. Oh, well.
Yeah. And I couldn't get him to sit and pose for the picture until he did all the tricks.
Ah.
He was roping people. He was doing all kinds of stuff. But after a while, he sat. And the picture, if you notice, there's another guy in the picture.
Yeah, he's leaning on the table.
Yeah, he's passed out, or he Johnny knocked him out, or for all I know, he shot him. But mm-hmm. once I got Johnny to focus on the narrative part of the picture, see, there's always a narrative to every picture, and that's what makes most of the pictures, if not all of them, interesting.
Uh-huh.
It's a narrative portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
of course, each picture tells a story, and a lot of the portraiture is performance. That's what portraiture should be. It should
right.
be performance. And because Johnny had... in his mind, a performance, he was able to take the picture, and he was able to do what you see the picture is doing, which is basically sitting there with a grin, which was hard to do for that amount of time and time exposure,
mm-hmm.
and with that guy out, passed out on the table. So that's how I got him to take the portrait.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. You do tell... quite a fascinating backstory to the photo of Denver Pyle.
Yeah, Denver.
That was the first. That was the first essay that I wrote was Denver.
Mm-hmm. Oh, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Denver's story, did I explain that he died 2 weeks after that photo?
No.
All right. Let me tell you something about that photo. That was the second session with Denver. The first session didn't come off because Denver wasn't well. He's on chemo during the first and second session. The first session, he has tubes running out of him, and there's a tank behind him. And the first set of images, he's totally white. There's no features in his face.
Uh-huh.
there aren't any features at all based on the fact that when you have a person, and I don't, and this is a anomaly that I don't understand, because when they shoot corpses and they're able to get features in the face, I don't know how they do it. Maybe it's because it's a very long exposure, or the corpse is very fresh. Because when somebody doesn't feel well or is ill, it's very hard to take a picture because the technique and the ghost photography fails. And with Denver, it failed in that I couldn't get his features to show up on his face the first session. So I had him come back. I asked Tippy, his wife, to bring him back, and Denver agreed. And when he came back, he was feeling much better, and I was able to take that picture. And 2 weeks after, he passed away.
Oh, that's a sad story.
Yeah,
that's
quite sad. But
that's
he was
interesting.
He was a great guy. But yeah, the technique itself, taking those pictures, the actor has to project an energy.
Right.
And that's the only way to get the photo.
You must...
If it detects or doesn't detect energy, it doesn't record on the film.
Through this process, I can only imagine that you learned a whole lot between the first photograph and as you went through this. Like, for instance, in that case with Denver, was that the first time that, like, what were your thoughts as you looked at the, you know, like, did you wonder what it was you had not processed correctly, or did it just come to your mind immediately what the problem had been?
No, I did 4.5 years of tests prior to doing the book.
Mm-hmm.
And also I read about ghost photography and anomalies. They're called anomalies. And, you know, you get all kinds of ghosting that happens when you do these this technique. It doesn't only happen during the long exposure. It happens during the process.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at old photographs, you'll see all kinds of anomalies on the faces and in the backgrounds and standing next to the subject. There's all ghosts. There's lots of ghosts in those photos.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it truly is fascinating. It fascinated me 2 years ago, and still fascinating.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed too, you have a Facebook page specifically for the book, and I've had a lot of fun checking in there regularly. And you post a nice sort of trio of pictures. You put up your handwritten set design and props and such. And then you put up like a color photo, and then you put up the portrait. So much time has gone into each one of these. I mean, you don't use the same set over and over again. What became the inspiration for each setting that you created?
Conversation with the actor,
okay,
to begin with, and then research based on the conversation, and then some kind of a idea that would sort of like support the conversation and the design of the set. I mean, a lot of the sets are, and I wasn't kidding about smoke and mirrors, they're not what you think you're seeing. A lot of it is with mirrors, actually, because the lighting, I use over 35 lights.
Oh, wow.
And we use a lot of smoke. I mean, Courtney was present during a lot of the shooting, and he can tell you that a lot of these sets are fake, you know, fake in the sense that, excuse me, what you see is illusions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain it. I mean, a lot of it is physical. You know, I had to produce three-dimensional lighting effects to create dimension, because the camera that I was using is a very special camera. It's a Hasselblad flex body camera that creates depth of field, and it creates like a three-dimensional quality. If you look at the photographs, they're very three-dimensional.
Yeah.
They're not normal photographs in that digital. They don't look digital.
Right.
They have a depth.
Right. Field. Yes, they do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a foreground, middle ground, and a background, and the focus varies in each of the photographs because the camera has many knobs on it that, because of the bellows and the shutter in the lens, you can create that type of depth control.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the actor is in focus, the background and the foreground can be manipulated.
Right.
And depending on what artifacts I want to, point out and emphasize, I can do it with lights. And using mirrors, I can project light, bend light, and do all kinds of things to it. So it's very complicated. It takes me about 3 weeks to design a set.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Let's take a minute out, if you wouldn't mind, and let's hear from Out West, the Cowboy Store.
Once upon a time, there was a man and wife. This man and his wife loved serving others through the retail trade. One day, the man heard a voice whisper, "Go west." His wife did not hear the voice. The next day, the voice commanded, "Go west." And they did. And they found themselves in a new land, and it was good. And the voice said, "Open a business." And they did. And they called the business Out West, as that was where they were. And the voice said, "Invite authors and artists and musicians to Out West." And they did. And today that business continues to provide platforms for those with the creative spirit and great merchandise. And the voice exclaimed, "Use coupon code RADIO when you shop at outwestshop.com. And the man and his wife, their friends and customers live happily ever after. Because it's always a great day out west.
And we are back with our guest tonight, Steve Carver and Courtney Joyner. And if you want to call and talk to these two gentlemen who are fascinating to conversationalists, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. Court, here's a question for you.
Sure.
Okay. You did the biographies on the right hand side of the pages, and you write. I mean, some of your biographies are pretty complete. And how much did you? I mean, how much did you already know about these actors, and how long did you have to sit with each actor to get the information you needed to write their biography?
Well, it really depended. You know, of course, Steve had said when I came along, he had been working on this for years. And of course, and some of the folks unfortunately had already passed, such as Denver Pyle, and I think David was gone by the time I got involved. So there was a matter of just going back, and I mean, I remember I had met Denver Pyle once, but like with that one, I think that was the very first biography I wrote, and I told Steve I got very excited because going into like Denver's background, I found out that his brother was an animator at Walt Disney Studios, which I did not know.
Yeah.
So going into these backgrounds of people that, you know, you have met casually or what have you, led me to a lot of different research. And then when the people would come down to Steve's studio and I would sit there with them, we would have a conversation. And then as a rule, if I didn't know them previously, then we would either get together for lunch or over the phone. So it was usually about two interview sessions with the person. And then sometimes we just had to play catch up because there were some folks who were very busy. They'd had their photograph taken. And then sometime later, we would finally hit them up, like Marty Cove or whoever it would be, because he was off making his television series. And we would just, have him sit down with me, and we would do the session. But they're all, it was usually, I would say, at least, it was always, of course, one, but as a rule, we tried to go, I tried to go at least two or at least one and a half, if you will, mm-hmm. so that, because I would have additional questions and verification of things and, you know, that type of stuff.
But then you also wrote the 100,000-word essay at the back of the book.
Yes. Well, it was cut from 100.
Yeah, I know. We had this conversation.
Yes. Yes. But, yes, I did. Yes, the additional book at the end of the book. Yeah.
Is that like the meeting after the meeting?
Yeah, well, that one kind of got away from me a little bit. I got very enthused for that one.
That's pretty funny, actually.
But you know, he's talking about the idea of, you know, each actor and how the sessions kind of evolved, and discussing it with the actors, and of course his own concepts of how he wanted to go. With some cases, the actors, I can think of a few, were actually making almost direct references to parts that they had played, and I'm speaking in this case very specifically about Bruce Davison.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because that was, of Ozanna's Raid.
Because of Ozanna's Raid, exactly. And so there, you know, that was a great taking off point. And so that was wonderful because we were kind of centering things on not, I mean, of course, he made quite a number of Westerns, but Robert Aldrich and Burt Lancaster and that being his first movie and all. So that was a wonderful starting off place. But then when you have somebody like L.Q. Jones, who is, you know, basically my second dad, because we've known each other for so long, and Steve's known him even longer. I mean, I've known LQ for 40 years. There, you're talking about a width and breadth of a career that is so incredibly enormous. And so there, to me, it was, well, what is the image? And that image is so personified in that great photograph, that kind of smiling rascal that he played better than just about anybody.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like, okay, there, it's like, it's that public persona. You know, LQ always said people never could recognize where they knew him from. Mm. But he would, you know, he would often get approached by people who say, no, I know you from somewhere. And sometimes they did, even though he couldn't recognize him as an actor. But he was just such a familiar presence who would enter their lives through the movies or a television show or something, and he stuck. And so, right. You know, you have to write about that, that there's a familiarity and like a friendship, I think, that communicates between audiences and character actors that sometimes and Steve mentioned this earlier, is not always the case with the leading man.
Right. Right. Well, LQ is the kind of guy that you see him in a movie and you go, who is that guy? I know what I've seen him 100 times.
Mm-hmm. 1,000 times.
Now I have a totally different kind of question, and this is to you, Steve. Again, I think I was maybe on the book's Facebook page last week sometime, and I was scrolling down through lots and lots of photos, and somebody commented that a lot of the pictures the main character doesn't appear to be wearing any footwear, and was kind of curious, and that really got my attention. I thought I've got to ask Steve about that.
I just cleared that up Tuesday with the fellow. Let me just say the same thing I said to him. Every actor wants something different, and every body sort of like comes to the same conclusion. Everybody has the same idea. So a lot of actors come with an idea, let's do something because everybody's wearing boots. Let's do something about the feet. And you take a guy, you take someone like Max Gale who said, I want to wrap my foot and show that I have a bad toe. And that's what he did. You know, he had a little accordion or whatever that little box was in his hand, little instrument, and he said, I want to show that I had a bad foot. So we did away with the boot, and he wrapped his foot. Then you have another guy who, you know, like Robert Woods, who had a fireplace, and he wanted to dry some socks, and he had bad toes, and he didn't want to wear boots because the boots would irritate his toes. So he went barefoot. So, you know, that's an accumulation of actors not wanting to wear boots. So it wasn't a boot fetish. It was just their choices not to wear boots. We had some actors that had enormous feet, you know, 15, 16 and a half foot.
Wow. Wow.
Who's going to have boots for them? That's a foot and a half. And who's going to have boots for them? Nobody's going to have any boots for them, even though we had gigantic boots. No one, you know, they didn't fit into them because they weren't wide enough or whatever enough. Yeah. So we had some of the pictures without boots, and it just happened to have an accumulation of pictures without boots. And they were cool, you know.
That's
their choices.
Right.
So that's why some of them. I didn't have a foot fetish.
Here, Steve, we've got to tell the Bob Forster boot story.
Well, go ahead.
Yes. Oh, this is great. We're shooting with Bob, who was just the nicest guy. You know, he was so terrific. And we were down there at the studio, and he and I were talking, and he said, and he just sat there. He was putting on his boots. And Steve, I think you remember this. He put them down, and he looked at me. He said, "Did you see this?" And I said, "No, what?" And he said, "Look at this. The boots that had been rented for him were the same pair that Gregory Peck wore in The Stalking Moon."
Oh, get out of here. Are you serious?
Wow.
And it was total coincidence. Yep.
Or not. Coincidence or not.
Total coincidence.
Hence the title of the picture, Stalking the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
We had a lot of wardrobe from other actors because I bought a lot of wardrobe, and a lot of the people who supplied the wardrobe, like Al Frisch and Bobby Zinner, who were excellent wardrobe people and collectors of wardrobe. A lot of the labels were of very famous actors, and we had lots of great wardrobe from lots of.
Yeah, that was that was wonderful. I just knocked Bob right out. He just thought it was fantastic.
And I noticed you had Rudy Lee in here, and that one night, Bobby Jean and I rode down the elevator at LA Talk Radio there.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
And she would come to things at the Autry all the time. We would see her at.
Yeah, Rudy Lee was holding the same exact firearm that was used by, what's the gal? What's the famous? It slips my mind right now. She was portraying Annie Oakley.
Oh.
If you look at the poster in back of her photograph on the wall from the Wild.
Oh, yeah, Buffalo Bill's
Wild West. Yeah.
Yes. That, you know, piece, I believe.
And the shotgun. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a $1 million shotgun that was by the collector who brought it. That's the actual piece.
Wow.
None of us could touch it except for Ruta.
Wow. When you photographed, when that shotgun was part of the photograph, did it speak to the camera also? I mean, do the props have as much spirit in them as the main?
Well,
the main person?
I may have told this story the last time I was with you, but every prop does have a story, and every prop has a something about it that not only does something, not only to the actor, but if the story be told, it influences everything. And I'll tell this story, and forgive me if I told it again, but when I was early shooting the test shots, and L.Q. Jones showed up right after I shot Archie Armstrong, the first photo, and we were doing test shots, not for the book. We weren't even thinking of doing a book. And Archie Armstrong came as a Westerner, and L.Q. Jones came next. I called him up because I had worked with them, and put him in cowboy clothes. I built a set, a barn, and Bobby Zinner came with a a Springfield rifle. It was used in the 1800s by a marshal. It killed 22 people.
Holy mackerel.
And just holding that piece, that Springfield, you can feel the vibes, and it was incredible. I mean, you can feel that it was a murderous piece. And we leaned it against the side of the wall, the left side of this barn, supposedly, and we took LQ's photograph. It's not in the book. It was just a test shot. I put it in the book, put it on Facebook a few times, just as a test shot. And, you know, it's a shot of LQ. And that was just a test shot. 1 week later, I took a shot of Buddy Hackett. And Buddy's shot happened to be in the book. That was one of the shots that I used for the book.
Uh-huh.
The gun was not present. The gun was taken back by the collector, by Bobby Zinner, and given back by whomever he borrowed it from. Now, that week later, when the rifle was not present, it's in Buddy Hackett's shot.
Oh, my gosh.
Look at the book on the left side of the photograph. You'll see the ghost image of that rifle.
Oh, my gosh. The hair is standing up on my arms right now.
Well, comb it back down.
Wow.
The reason why these anomalies appear is because the energy from that rifle stayed there.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. We got to take one more break, guys, and we'll be back to you in just a minute, if you wouldn't mind. And let's hear a little bit about Creative Edge, the publicity people.
Okay, you've written a book. Now what are you going to do? Well, why don't you give Creative Edge Publicity a try? You see, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. Like an old pair of shoes or an old friend, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and they work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals. So Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future. Mickey Mickelson Publicists, and you can find them at www.creative-edge.services.
And that's for Creative Edge Publicity. Great people, Mickey Mickelson, and they're actually my publicists. And as we roll around the corner, I notice that you have Box Leitner in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go team penning with Bruce up in to Two Winds Ranch in Thousand Oaks. And I got to tell you, Steve, he's a real deal cowboy. He truly is.
Yes.
I mean, that guy, you'd swear that he came right out of the 1870s.
He was fun to work with.
Oh, I'm sure he was fun to team pen with. He's a big time jokester, and he loves life, and you can just tell.
Yes. Well, you know, Jim, you're hitting on also something here with whether it was Bruce or LQ or a number of other people are in the in the volume represented, is that they have this great identification with Westerns, but also with other genres. Bruce is a huge, as you know, science fiction star because of Tron and
Babylon 5.
And LQ, of course, you know, writing and directing A Boy and His Dog, which, you know, has become a cinema classic. Bruce Davison, of course, was the original Willard.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Absolutely, sure. So
Max Gale was in Barney Miller.
Absolutely, sure. So you have they also accomplished all these other things and all these other areas as just really wonderfully, you know, well-functioning utility actors. And there was Morgan Woodward, who loved his photograph. As Steve will say, he thought it was the best picture that anyone had ever taken of him. And to the very end, when people saw Morgan, boy, it was Cool Hand Luke.
Oh, yeah, huh?
Mm-hmm.
With the sunglasses.
The man with no eyes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is also a really wonderful thing about the book, just generally, is we're shining a light on, you know, these individuals, but also maybe some other accomplishments that people aren't completely aware of.
That's true. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fabulous book. It is absolutely fabulous. And it's available on Amazon and all online booksellers. And the name of the book, of course, is Western Portraits, The Unsung Heroes and Villains of the Silver Screen. And we've been talking with Steve Carver and C. Courtney Joyner. And guys, we're out of time.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it rolled by, didn't it?
Can't be.
So thank you so much for spending this hour with us this week. And God, we love having you. And come back and visit us, would you?
Well, thank you for having us.
Oh, absolutely. And Steve, I have to say, you did invite me to come down and watch some of the photography going on. But that happened to be the weekend, right the day before I had my hip surgery. So. And I remember you telling me you had two of them.
Yes.
So.
Well, I know we sure miss being there and seeing you both, you know, real face to face. So.
Right.
And just so delighted that it got published, Steve and Courtney. So delighted that it's getting the reception that it deserves, and we're just so excited for you and for this project.
Right. And of course, again, the book is available at Amazon and all online booksellers, and I'm sure bookstores as well.
Probably the Autry Museum store.
Oh, yeah. Or
support your local museum.
What the hell? Throw caution to the wind and send Court and Joyner an email, and he'll probably send you a copy for $40 and a signature.
If you get it from me, it's $300.
It's worth it.
That's because you're famous.
Yeah, for postage, you know.
Yeah,
I got that. All right, guys, thanks so much for joining us, and have yourselves a wonderful time. Stay in touch and come back and visit.
Oh, thank you, Jim. This was great.
Always a pleasure. And Steve, you take care of yourself, and I'm glad you got moved and everything's good.
Yep, everything's great.
Okay. And
Bobby Jean, take care.
Okay, guys. Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bobby.
Bye.
And next week we have what's it? Hank Phillips Ryan, Philippi Ryan. She's a mystery writer. Also a New York Times bestselling author, also mystery writer award. Also, I mean, the chick's got stuff hanging all over her walls.
So, can I quote you on that?
Sure. Anyway, that'll be next week, Hank Philippi Ryan. And for us and this week, and what a great conversation. I just love those guys.
Oh, I'm so delighted. And for our listeners, if you did not hear this show from 2016, you will enjoy going back and finding that one in the archives and taking a listen, because it was also a remarkable conversation.
Yep, it was in September of 2016.
I think September 22nd or 19 or
no,
something
it was before
like
the
that.
19th, because my surgery was the 19th, so it was like 15th or 14th or something like that. Anyway, for Bobby Jean. Thank you, Bobby Jean.
My pleasure.
And for Russ, who couldn't make it with us tonight, and myself, Jim Christina, and for the Writer's Block, we, of course, are out of here.